This is Car Expert.
The Genesis is better value, it's more interesting than the BMW, and it definitely rides better, but I still don't think it's a better car.
The Emira, I loved a lot of things about it. I thought it'd actually be a great replacement for the Elise.
A lot of the utes in the dual cab ute segment at the moment are going to start feeling and looking old very, very quickly.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. G'day, Paul Marrick.
G'day, Mandy. How are you?
Long time no talk.
Yes.
You've been looking after a baby, that's why.
Yes. Yeah, long time no sleep as well.
Yeah, true. And hello, Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy. Paula, you're looking even more tired than usual, mate.
Yes, my coffee is now a three-shot latte instead of my standard setup, and I think it's only just working.
Marco, you've been busily typing away our latest news story about Europe wanting to ban the sale of all petrol and diesel cars by 2035. It's a big statement to make, and really when you think about it, it's not very far away.
Yeah, so Brussels has proposed banning the sale of all combustion vehicles beyond that date. They wouldn't come to your house and confiscate your existing petrol and diesel car, but you just couldn't buy a new one after that date. The Grattan Institute, which is a government-backed think tank with some private funding as well, has also come out and supported a move for Australia. And then the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, that is the lobby group for all the car brands, has come out and said that's the dumbest thing. No, we're a different country. We can't ban petrol and diesel from 2035. And there's just been some disagreements around the fundamental idea. But I think the big picture piece here is we talk about EVs being the cars of tomorrow all the time, but Europe in 14 years won't sell you anything other than an EV, and that's not very far away. 14 years ago is 2007. That's not that long ago, right? So if you think about it in those terms, you know, it's not far away. And obviously those conversations are being had now in Australia too with a ton of different opinions, but, you know, it's at least it's sort of being talked about.
Well, also, Marco, it's worth pointing out that we won't get a choice no matter how much this chamber wants to you know, kick up a stink about it. We buy cars from overseas. We don't make cars here anymore. You buy what they sell you. And if they're not making internal combustion cars anymore, guess what? We're not going to get any. They're not just going to make them for Australia. So I don't know where they think they have any power or influence. And they're funded by car companies.
This is the big problem is, and look, you know, I might get in trouble for writing this story, but, you know, I've been speaking to quite a few car companies about this, and there are plenty of people working in car companies that don't agree with this position that do want EVs mandatory from 2035 because obviously their brands are in better positions. We all know what car manufacturers are well set up for that future versus ones that aren't. And clearly there are vested interests on every single side of this argument, on the EV side as well as the combustion side, like everybody has them. But yeah, Paulie, fundamentally, you're right. The future is electric, whether we like it or not, but also the technology will evolve. And just because an EV doesn't suit somebody out in the outback right now doesn't mean it won't always, you know, they'll be able to charge quicker and go longer and be lighter and all these things as time goes by. So we're all getting tied up in knots over a pretty small issue, I think, but it's fascinating to sort of watch it.
Mm. Which other countries have promised the sale of non-combustible engines, like in the nearest date?
Yeah, the list is growing. I mean, President Biden in the US has announced some pretty big reforms there regarding the rollout of electric cars only, particularly turning over the federal fleet. Lots of Asia, you know, parts of China and Japan have made those pledges. Lots of Europe have as well. So, you know, these dates are all being set. And as Paul said, though, realistically, if the United States, Europe and China decide to do something, the rest of the world's just going to inherit it, whether it likes it or not.
Yep. And we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about EVs coming up in the news, actually, which is now. All right, Paul, we'll start off with you. The 2022 Ford Ranger and Everest, a car expert or an avid car expert, reader and viewer, got some really interesting spy photos and videos of these two cars. What did he find?
So car expert reader Austin managed to snap a really cool video of the next generation Ford Everest and Ford Ranger testing in Melbourne. Now, a lot of the development work is still going on for these vehicles. They'll be sold globally and Ford Australia is involved extensively in making them happen. Now, I think it was a year and a half, 2 years ago, we exclusively did a story that basically told everyone that these vehicles were getting V6 powertrains, they were getting some plug-in hybrid technology, and also that Ford would be going down the path of a giant vertical infotainment screen in the center. And one of the drivers had the whole interior was covered up, but one of the drivers had one of the screens uncovered to type something in, and Austin managed to get some video of the screen, which is great. So it's basically confirmed that's coming, and it's big because this means that a lot of the utes in the dual cab ute segment at the moment are going to start feeling and looking old very, very quickly. We know that these cars are due to be announced at the end of this year or early next year and go on sale as early as mid next year. And you can just imagine having a top spec Ranger with one of these giant infotainment screens and a big V6 diesel parked next to something like a Hilux that, you know, looks like it was launched 10 or 15 years ago. It is really going to feel antiquated very quickly. And look, it's a good thing for ute buyers because it will advance the segment, especially with the Everest. I think they're going to put a lot of effort into that. But look, I'll just be very curious to see how it sort of pans out and what kind of scurrying the rest of the manufacturers are going to be doing in the next few months.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Moko?
Oh, I think this thing looks fantastic. And obviously the Ranger is one of the top two selling cars in the country. So anything that progresses the Ranger, progresses the car market by default. We also know that Volkswagen's going to have its own version of the Ranger in the form of the next Amarok, as is so common in the ute market. We've seen with Mazda and Isuzu getting in bed together. Often brands will supply one another with commercial vehicles. And I mean, that Amarok's probably going to be a pretty damn good thing too, Paulie, if the Ranger is anything to go by.
Yeah, and especially, I mean, Volkswagen will obviously have a big input in terms of how it all works, and they've had huge success with the V6 diesel here. So I have no doubts that this will probably become the best ute in the country, the Ranger and Volkswagen combo. So it'll be really interesting.
Yeah, and just on that, you touched on diesel, but there's also going to be a plug-in hybrid, which is pretty fascinating. I wonder how typical pickup buyers, you know, 20% of the market buy dual cab utes, I wonder how they're going to respond to the idea of a pickup plug-in hybrid and whether the fact the Ranger is so widely accepted might help that technology get the leg in it needs.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see how long it takes them to roll that out. Our understanding is that will come later on. But, you know, I think the segment's ready for it. And again, you look at what's around and no one really has a hybrid in that segment. Toyota obviously has easy access to that stuff, but I don't know that even Toyota has ever done a diesel hybrid. So it'll be interesting to see how it all sort of goes from here.
Yeah, very interesting indeed. Well, speaking of that, Moko, Tesla has teamed up with BHP in Western Australia. This is a neat little local story for us. What are they doing?
It is. If there's one thing Australia's really good at, it's digging stuff out of the ground and then sending it elsewhere. It's something that Hyundai and Kia, every Hyundai and Kia made around the world is made with Australian iron ore. And, you know, this is just another example where so BHP, obviously massive multinational mining corporation headquartered in Melbourne, but with lots of its mines in the Pilbara, the north of Western Australia, has a nickel mine. It's made a lot of moves lately to really clean up its act in terms of carbon emissions. Done a lot, you know, at least by mining industry standards to sort of meet the Paris Convention and things like that. And it's been rewarded by companies like Tesla turning to it to supply nickel because nickel is a major part of battery packs. And it gives the company a lot of cred. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at Tesla that the chairperson of Tesla, the chairperson of the whole board is an Australian, Robin Denholm, who was a former executive Telstra. And obviously now, you know, we're going to see batteries using Australian minerals. It adds a kind of Aussie story to the world's most popular EV. But I just can't help but wonder, you know, it's one thing to send the raw materials that go in the batteries overseas, but wouldn't it be awesome if we could value add and actually make the batteries here? You know, we've got the lithium, we've got the nickel, we've got all the stuff in the ground, we've got the engineers, we've got the expertise, the education centers, universities and the like. Obviously not with very high standards, otherwise Paulie wouldn't have got his degree. But why is it that we can't, you know, level up and make the batteries as well as just providing the raw materials?
Makes no sense at all. Like, I mean, it would be the perfect opportunity to make jobs. You're mining the stuff right here. I mean, hello, let's just get a clue here and make something happen. I just think Australia is, like you said, they're just so good at I don't know, half-assing some of this stuff. It's just really disappointing we're not just making batteries here.
It's awesome that we're endowed with plenty of minerals in the ground, but we really need to just squeeze as much out of them as we can, yeah?
Now, Northern Territory is committed to electric car incentives, joining many other states in Australia, Paul.
Yeah, well, I feel kind of bad now supporting Victoria for taxing EVs and creating a fair system when every other state in the country seems to be helping EV drivers. I feel like I'm getting ripped off here. So the Northern Territory has announced that they will be integrating free registration and reduced stamp duty as part of an electric vehicle uptake. This will also include the government adding 20 electric vehicles to its fleet each year as it moves towards having 200 EVs on the fleet by 2030. Obviously, this is a clear intention to increase the pace of EV ownership in the Northern Territory, and it makes perfect sense. It really does make Victoria look quite backwards in comparison to the rest of the states, and it baffles me how we don't have a national system in place. How can you possibly have Victoria where I have to pay to have an EV, yet in New South Wales, it's going to be the opposite. They'll pay me to have an EV.
Yeah, well, it's so convoluted, as you say. I mean, Victoria obviously launched a $3,000 subsidy, but then with one hand gave and with the other took away by charging you a mileage tax. New South Wales has got its own deferred mileage charge with a subsidy. The ACT has got interest-free loans for EV buyers and no stamp duty. The Northern Territory has something now. South Australia's put out to tender, it's asked all of the lobby groups to come up with an idea for what it should do. And, yeah, that's the fundamental problem, isn't it, Paul? We're a country of 24 million people, and yet we're going to have 9 or 8 different electric car policies. And somebody who buys an EV in Perth versus Melbourne versus Darwin are going to have completely different incentives and subsidies and tax cuts and all sorts of things. We're not China. We're not America. We're not a massive country. The idea that we can't just have one standard, like whether you agree or not with government incentives, it doesn't really matter. It's an irrelevant political discussion. But like surely we should just have one idea. Some people will say that the states fighting against each other is good because it encourages, innovation and things like that. But it's just confusing to car buyers. You got to pay more or less depending on where you live. That's just not right. Yeah.
And the other thing I find bizarre as well, with Victoria, for example, I pay per kilometre. Now, with the fuel surcharge, it kind of made sense that it's a national thing. You pay for wherever you drive, depending on how much fuel that you use. That all makes perfect sense. The Victorian EV tax goes to the government, presumably to help stuff in Victoria, infrastructure, roads, blah, blah, blah. If I drive my car from here to Brisbane, which obviously I'm not allowed to do at the moment due to the state of things, but I have to pay for the kilometres that I do outside of Victoria that then gets paid back to Victoria, even though I'm damaging roads in other states. Like it just truly is a poorly thought out system. But they've got one caveat in there, and that's if you drive on a private road, you can get exempt for the portion that you've driven on a private road. So if I drove to, a supermarket, for example, I could make a claim for the 200 metres that I drove on private property.
Wow.
But not for the interstate stuff. It is genuinely stupid.
So, so confusing. If you have any thoughts, email podcast@carexpert.com.au. And lastly, for our last EV story, Moco, 2022 BYD E6 is coming to Australia, and it's a pretty good price too, from what I can see.
Yeah, it's very EV-centric, this new segment, isn't it? BYD, otherwise known as the Chinese electric car brand backed by Warren Buffett, that investor who doesn't get too many things wrong, who make buses for basically every country in the world. Electric buses is kind of their thing. BYD wisely said, if we can prove that our batteries work in buses, then we can prove they work in cars, and that's exactly what it's done. There's a company called Nexport, which is an independent distributor that's done a deal with BYD to sell electric cars in Australia from this year online. So the T3 van and the EA1 hatch will launch this year from about $35,000, which would be the cheapest EV on sale if it can deliver what it says it's going to deliver. And it's also done some big deals with rideshare partners like Uber and Didi to get EVs in the fleet. And the latest news is, yeah, the BYD E6, which is an MPV, a bit like the Toyota Prius V. So it's the size of a Mitsubishi Outlander SUV, but it's more of an MPV-style people mover. $39,990 before on-road cost is the claim. A 500K driving range is what the company is claiming from its 70 kilowatt-hour battery pack. We've got to see that put against WLTP standards to know for sure. So we'll just wait on that one and maybe we'll drive it ourselves. But $40,000 for a, you know, big comfy SUV / MPV electric car that is sort of semi-modern and looks the part, it's going to get a lot of people talking. The caveat is there's only a small number coming in. Nexport has decided that the EA1 hatch and the T3 van are its bread and butter cars, but it's going to bring small numbers of other BYD models into the country just to see if people are interested. And what it's saying is if the response is good, that it can secure more of them and bring in essentially as many as it wants. So I think you'll find that that initial allocation will get snapped up pretty quick. We've seen MG ZS has become the second most popular EV in the market after the Tesla Model 3. It's from China. It's really cheap. BYD is cut from very much the same cloth. And the fact that, you know, again, whether you're for or against EVs, the fact that the existing brands have been quite slow in Australia to get on board means that there's room for these startup companies to launch and they don't have a lot of competition, and it's going to be really fascinating to see how they go.
Is it just me or does this all sound too good to be true? I don't know that anything has anything materialized with BYD. They seem to be...
Well, so Nexport, the importer, is part of a wider conglomerate that has a lot of money behind it that sells electric buses to the government of New South Wales and has been for some time. So this is not some, you know, invented shell company with no track record. There is some cred here. Likewise, BYD is a very big company in China. It sells millions of cars. So everybody involved in this has a degree of legitimacy, but... That being said, we haven't seen the cars launch yet and the price points spoken about haven't been confirmed yet and we haven't driven them yet. So there's certainly a degree of uncertainty, but I think there's enough there to say that it's certainly worth keeping an eye on.
Well, other question I had as well, that one of the reasons you would buy an MG is because right now, whether people like it or not, they're almost an established player. They've got a huge dealer network, decent warranty. People buy their other cars because they're happy with them. But BYD, we've seen with Havel, for example, isn't that the China's biggest SUV brand? They sell bugger all cars in Australia. So BYD might be a huge brand in China, but it doesn't really mean anything in Australia. So I wonder whether they will have enough influence and enough of a network to actually get off the ground here, regardless of price.
They're the fundamental questions, aren't they? I mean, we've seen GWM Haval set up its own factory-backed operation in Australia, and it's cost it millions of dollars to get to the place where it has enough dealers to actually give people confidence to buy its cars. And that's exactly right. You've got this startup distributor that's talking the right talk, but you've got to have places to fix them and service them and maintain them. And there's a whole ecosystem around supporting, you know, cars, and the more you sell, the harder it gets. So definitely they still have a lot to prove.
Certainly do. You can click the news link at carexpert.com.au if you would like to read more on those stories. We spoke about the last internal combustion Lotus, the Emira, 2 weeks back on the podcast, and we marvelled at how damn beautiful it is. Well, one of the Car Expert founders thought the same, but he went one step further and ordered one. Hello, Alborz.
Hello, guys. How are you? It's been a while since I've been here.
It's been yonks.
It's, it's called Car Expert. You should really read the site. It's fantastic.
You guys are so Victorian-based. It's like Dan Andrews runs this podcast. I never get to actually speak here.
Now, we know you already have a Lotus Elise you bought a few weeks back. So why did you decide on the Emira?
I bought that Elise a while ago now. It was actually the old Car Advice Elise that I did Targa in. And then when Channel 9 decided that it was a really good idea to sell every car that Car Advice owned, I decided to pick that one up. So I've had that car for a few years. I actually love it. The Emira.
With the dent in the bonnet.
Yeah. Let's not talk about who put that there, but that person still works at a different organization.
It's like marriage, but slightly different.
slightly taller too. Anyway, The Emira, honestly, like you said, I saw it when it came out, and it just looks, it really does look great, doesn't it? It really does look great. And I loved it in that blue. I loved a lot of things about it. And I thought, you know, it would actually be a great replacement for the Elise because it's just so much more modern. That Elise is, you know, 25 years old in its technology. And every time I get in and out of it, I want to hang myself in the process. So it's not the nicest car to sort of get in and out of. But and then I kind of was taken by a bit of shock when they announced the AMG engines. I don't know if anyone really knew that was coming. I certainly didn't. I think we all thought it was going to be powered by that Toyota engine. So that AMG stuff came as a bit of a surprise and actually made me really interested in the car even more, because as much as I love having a Turago engine in my Lotus, the having an actual modern, up-to-date engine was far more appealing. And I called up with full anticipation of thinking that the AMG unit would be significantly more expensive than the Toyota engine. But as it worked out, it was completely the other way around, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But it changed my mind on because I was like, oh, I'm not sure if I want to spend all the money on getting the AMG unit. I'll stick with Toyota. But they're like, oh, no, it's actually the other way around. It's like, oh, I don't know how, but I will go with the AMG unit. But there's no way in the world that that AMG unit would cost less to make than that 45-year-old Toyota engine.
Yeah, that is odd.
It's bizarre.
Did you get a chance to spec the car, Albers, or is it too early days yet?
I've got a rough idea of what's going to be in the first edition cars, which is what I'm getting. I can't tell you the price, but I would say look at Cayman as a comparison. It's around that sort of price point. Apparently, they've got over 35 orders already, which is for a Lotus, kind of like having 50,000 orders from Australia. Like it's unheard of to have that many Lotuses.
You know why? Why is this all of a sudden so popular? Is it just because of the Mercedes-Benz involvement, you reckon?
I think because it actually looks like a supercar and it doesn't cost like a supercar. Mm. Like I if you measure it against a Huracan, it's almost similar proportions. And I know the Huracan's a smaller car in general, but it's a much bigger, I think, proportions than an Exige. And I think it looks a lot more modern. And I think it looks really expensive. I actually thought it'd be a bit more expensive than the Cayman pricing, but that's what it is. And yeah, it looks awesome, man. I think it looks fantastic. I hope that it actually looks like that with the interior and everything when it gets out.
So do you think, obviously they've been doing cars for a while now, do you think it will be faster than a Tesla Model 3?
No, but it'll do more than two laps. It'll do more than two laps before
like
catching
Lotus
on fire.
I don't know that it will.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I don't know. It doesn't arrive till mid next year, apparently, and you know, at the moment everything's delayed, so it might even be later than that. But yeah, and you know what's really interesting, and I didn't know this, but the Lotus's parent company, is it Geely? Is that how you say it? Geely, whatever it is. They actually own 10% of Daimler. I did not know that. There you go.
That kind of makes the Mercedes connection make sense then.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, and probably they actually can get the engine cheaper from Mercedes than Toyota would sell them a 30-year-old engine.
Maybe they own 5% of Uber, which is where they've got the Toyota engines.
Have you got a rego plate all worked out yet, Wolf?
No, and I really need a rego plate for my 3000 GT, so I'm open to suggestions.
Rubbish? Is that too many characters for Queensland?
No, I got that for your Tesla when you come up. I'm not sure. So if anyone's listening and has got a good suggestion for a 3000 GT number plate in Brisbane, please get in touch.
So what are you planning on doing with the Emira? Is it just going to sort of sit with your other cars? Are you going to plan to race it? Got any plans?
I plan to take a photo of it in my garage, and I plan for Paul to say, I haven't seen that angle before.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I think we've covered angles 1 to 179 degrees. I'm really looking forward to seeing what 180 looks like.
To answer your question legitimately, I'm looking to replace the Elise, I think. I think it'd be nice to have a modern Lotus. And it's if it is the last non-hybrid or non-EV Lotus, which is what they've said, then also there's a bit of a – you know, there's a bit of thing going on with it there. So, yeah.
Well, what's just sort of, because I think a lot of people won't know, what's it like to service a Lotus? Is it expensive? Is it reasonable?
Well, the Elise is ridiculous. It's like servicing a Corolla. You're literally using Toyota genuine parts for the filter and the oil, and the brakes and the calipers and everything are so cheap. Like, that's why it's such a great track car. because it doesn't weigh much, so it doesn't chew through tires and brakes, and its servicing is Corolla servicing, so any Muppet can do it. Except for me, I don't service it myself. I have no idea how that works. But I suspect the AMG unit will be way different, right? Like if you bought the Exige, a power plant like that 3.5 India Mira, then maybe it'll be the same thing. It'd be like servicing a Orion because that's the same engine. But I think with the 2-liter AMG unit, it might be a whole different world. And I don't know you'd almost be taking it to Merck to get it serviced almost, it's not like currently Lotus Australia has a clue how to service that motor.
Well, actually, that's a good point you make. A mutual friend of ours who we won't name because he's still going through the process at the moment, but he bought a Toyota with a BMW engine and he's had an issue.
Kind of like you, right?
Yes. Yeah. He's had an issue with his and Toyota has absolutely no idea how to fix it and they want to charge him so their techs can learn on his engine. So, I'll be keen to see how that pans out because I always thought that was going to be a problem. Like if you service Toyotas day in, day out, all of a sudden you bring in a completely different engine type you've never seen before and require a whole set of tools and diagnostic stuff. How are you going to actually do anything more than an oil filter change? And I wonder whether that's going to be the same with Lotus.
Yeah, and you know what? I think brands are going to need to evolve. And can you imagine when they all go to hybrid and EV? Like all these companies now that have no idea, like all these service managers and technicians that have never dealt with an electric or a hybrid. And, in the next 10 years, that's what it's all going to be. And I can only imagine the fun that will be when you come in and go, oh, my hybrid system's not working. They're going to go, uh-huh, there's a trash can and you can go buy a new car.
So the prank on apprentices will be electrocuting them with 450 volts of battery power.
Yeah, I'll leave that to you to do, Paul, as the resident civil engineer in the company.
Civil engineer. He still doesn't know I have a mechanical engineering degree.
You wouldn't know it by talking to you, that's for sure.
Touché.
All right, boys. Well, for the first time, we can actually say really nice taste in cars.
What do you mean for the first time? I have great cars.
Your Ferrari is the color of a taxi.
Maybe in Melbourne. They're orange in Brisbane, so all my other cars are colors of taxis. This is coming from a guy who's got a Model 3 that looks the word I can use is not politically correct, so I won't use it, but it doesn't look great. Let's put it that way.
It's okay to use.
Yeah, I really doubt that, but anyway. Hey, guess what we're doing? Guess what we're doing soon?
What?
We're putting a new M4 against a C63. And I've got them right now in my house, and I got to tell you, that new M4 looks great in person.
I agree. I think it looks offensive in pictures, but in person, it actually looks bloody awesome.
But have you sat in the one with the carbon seat?
No.
It's got this really weird part in the middle of your legs that's meant to hold the harness, but it looks like it's meant to hold something else, like a part of your body. I don't want to say what, but it's the weirdest. It's the weirdest thing. I sat in it. I'm like, what is this thing between my legs? It's just bizarre. There's so many jokes I could make back then.
All right, boys, we'll let you go. Thanks for the chat.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one. Bye.
I don't know if you guys can relate, but one of my worst nightmares is having one of my cars stolen and never being able to get it back. About 12 months ago, I spent a decent amount of money on car trackers, only to find they didn't really work. But Paul, you've put 3 tracking devices to the test in our latest comparison video just to see how well they work. What were the devices and can you tell us exactly how they work?
Yes. So basically when we ran the experience center in Sydney, each of the cars that were out on test drives actually had a GPS tracker inside them. And Apple recently announced the creation of the AirTag, and Samsung had their own device that was recently upgraded to match the specifications of the Apple device. So I thought, let's do a comparison between the Apple AirTag, the Samsung SmartTag Plus, and an LTE GPS tracker. So it's a GPS tracker that has its own 4G SIM card inside. And the results were interesting. So just as a bit of background, the Apple AirTag and the Samsung SmartTag Plus both work on UWB, which is ultra wideband. It's just a different type of communication method. It uses a ultra wideband bandwidth to communicate, and that means that it doesn't get interference like some devices do. And the curious thing with these is they just have a small chip inside and a battery. There's no SIM cards. They don't have an ability to communicate with the mobile network. But what they do have the ability to do is communicate with like devices. So with Apple, it's able to communicate with Apple devices that have iOS 14.5 or later. And with the Samsung device, it's able to communicate with Samsung devices. There you go. Who would have thought? The GPS tracker then just uses a mobile phone network to relay its location. Now, the way that these devices do their thing is if you're within, I think it's a range of around 100 meters, the devices are able to communicate with the phone. The phone that you're using is always on the lookout for these devices if it's compatible. When it does detect one of those devices, it sends a precise GPS location to Apple or to Samsung. And then that location is visible by that device's owner. So if I have an AirTag in my car and someone walks past or drives past with an Apple device, that location is sent to Apple. And then using my phone, I'm able to log in and see where that device was last seen. So what we did, we set up an experiment. We had a BMW 3 Series in the garage, the one that Scott just spoke about. And we taped an AirTag, a SmartTag Plus, and the GPS tracker to the dashboard of the car. In addition to that, we also used BMW Connected Drive, which was fitted to the car that has its own GPS tracking module inside it. I then got Scott to drive to a location about 40 kilometers away where I know that there is zero phone reception. And along the way, he was going to pass four checkpoints. And at each of those checkpoints, I would do a check to see which device has located him. One of the checkpoints was just outside a tunnel where obviously you have limited phone reception and no GPS reception. And at that first checkpoint, we found that the Samsung device and the GPS tracker both located the car, but the Apple device was still stuck at the entrance to the tunnel. And as we kept going along at each of the next updates before we lost reception, the Apple device was always 5 minutes out from the Samsung device. The Samsung device was always quite accurate. So it showed that, there is variability in how well these devices work. Final location was no phone reception. And when we got there, as luck would have it, none of the devices worked, but we wanted to see which was closest. And funnily enough, the Samsung device measured within around 500 meters of Scott's last known destination and the GPS tracker within around 100 meters. Now, the thing that we noticed here is that it depends entirely on what you have in the vicinity. As Scott got towards the sort of more remote areas, there was sort of nothing around and you had less phones to bounce off, but there were still enough Samsung phones. And our theory as to why the Apple phones weren't working as efficiently was because it needs iOS 14.5 or later. So a lot of people still haven't updated there. Apple has overwhelmingly more market share in Australia. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to touch on, Paulie. You sort of addressed it, but my impression was that the vast majority of smartphones in Australia are Apple. It's certainly the most well-known. Yeah. And, you know, we're not talking about all Android here, are we? We're talking about just Samsung. So it seems like it's quite surprising to me that one of them actually had users at all.
Let's do an experiment. Both get your phones out. You both use iPhones. And if you go to the settings menu and then go general and then about, up the top there under the phone name, it'll have software version. Which version are both of you on at the moment?
13.4.1.
Right.
I am on 14.6, my good man.
Cool. Yeah, so we're on the same one. We're both up to date. Mandy, yours is older because...
Get with the times, Turner.
I'm vintage.
But this is the thing, right? I think a lot of people are going to be in that scenario. They could just be one or two updates out of date and they're not able to relay this device. So I have a feeling if we redid this test in a year's time, it would be very different. And the key thing to note as well is the price. So the Apple device is something like $40. The Samsung was about $55. The GPS tracker has an upfront cost of, I think it was $150 with a $7 a month monthly fee. The two Apple and Samsung devices, the battery needs to be changed just once a year. So that just lasts basically forever, forever up until you need to change it. And then the GPS tracker is every 3 to 6 months you need to charge it. And with the nature of the Apple and the Samsung, you could literally just stick that anywhere in the car, just set and forget, change the battery once a year, and you've got an effective solution. I mean, it's going to be good enough for the job. Obviously, thieves will be able to check if there's a device nearby. I mean, Apple has now put that sort of that into place with those AirTags. But ultimately, I think it's just a cheap way to keep track of your car And once, you know, these become more popular and we get more of these phones out there, I just think it'd be an easy way to sort of know exactly where it is. So, Mandy, have I convinced you? Will you give up your GPS trackers for one of these?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say to you, Paul, when you were doing your research into which tracking devices to use, I spent like $200 on two of them because I have two classic cars. And I bought one specifically that would alert me if a car was moving. Because mine's staying in a shed half the year. And that's the reason why I bought it. And it looked exactly the same one as in the video, like a big black box. Put a SIM card in it and everything. The tracking was so, so accurate, but it never notified me when the car moved, which defeated the whole purpose of why I wanted to buy it. Did you find any decent trackers? I know it's like one little extra feature that you didn't include in that comparison. Did you find, are these common?
Look, we generally, the ones that we used at the experience center worked well, and the brand was Solid GPS, and it's an Australian brand. But the problem was the one that we had on the day, it just wouldn't recognize movement. I even put it into emergency mode. It just didn't recognize movement. It would update every 10 minutes, which was kind of pointless because you can travel a long way in 10 minutes, as I discovered. So I don't know if the device was faulty or whatever the excuse is. Obviously, it's not good enough. If your car goes missing, you need this thing to work. So, you know, I don't know. I think the most accurate way is obviously to buy a brand new BMW or something like that, which I don't know if you're interested in doing that, Mandy, but we found that to be very accurate. Every time I hit refresh on the web page, it was pinpoint accurate because it was using the car. The car, if the car's on, it's relaying. But if your car's stolen, put on a trailer, or if the battery dies, that device is effectively pointless. So, I really think these two are just the best way to do it. I don't know whether you can geofence these devices, but if you were to have some method of being able to trigger movement or an alarm at the storage facility, and if you get triggered that alarm, you can then at least start tracking them. The thieves are probably going to have a phone on them, and they're probably going to pass someone.
I know this is a total nuffy question, Marich, but I couldn't help but think this. In my head, you know, you just told me that the Samsung and the Apple one are both super cheap, you know, $40-$50 each, right? So buying one of each doesn't seem like a big stretch. You stick both in your car under the seat or whatever it is. But I presume to use the Samsung one, you need a Samsung device and vice versa for the Apple one, right? So you'd actually, to get the benefit, you'd actually have to have a requisite device.
Yeah, exactly. And look, you could, in theory, just go buy some cheap secondhand thing somewhere. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you have to have these new devices. And the other problem is you can't access them from other devices. So even if you have a family account set up, you couldn't delegate that to another device. And as far as I'm aware, the device needs to be with you to move it to another phone. So in theory, if your thing went missing and you had it registered to a phone but the phone wasn't on you, you wouldn't be able to track it because you just wouldn't be able to get to it. So, look, I think that they're definitely not designed to track cars, and I think that's not their intended purpose, but we were surprised with how well they did the whole car tracking thing. And I think if that was your end game, I'd be confident in recommending them to just stick them in the car. Assume it's not going to work, but if you don't want to rely on the police, then just hope for the best.
Do you use trackers on your old Holdens?
No, but I will just because, yeah, I mean, they're in secure storage and I've got a couple at home. But, yeah, now that I think of it, it's like, you know, when they're worth $1.5 million each, it is probably something I need to think about.
I'm just trying to wonder, why would you put little rubbish into secure storage? It doesn't make any sense. Who's going to want to knock it off?
Only sophisticated thieves, Mocha.
But sophisticated VN Commodore thieves, right.
Interesting. He doesn't get it, Mandy, does he?
No, he really doesn't. Well, if you haven't seen the video yet, I really encourage you to check it out. It is super interesting. So, head to carexpert.com.au. If you're a rare breed and are currently looking at purchasing a luxury sedan, well, first of all, snaps for you, but you will also find this latest comparison quite enticing. Scott Colley has put the BMW 320i and Genesis G70 head-to-head, and I've got to be honest, I'm not even sure which way this is going to go. Hello, Scully.
Hello, guys. How are we?
Very good. Now, why did you put the 320i and G70 head-to-head?
Well, it's a bit of an interesting one because the 3 Series is the sports sedan and the mid-size sedan benchmark, and it has been for a really long time. It's the car you think of when you think of that class. And the Genesis, like a lot of these sort of smaller brands, is a really interesting competitor that looks a bit more exciting than the 3 Series, promises to offer a bit more value than the 3 Series, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee it's a better car than the 3 Series. So it's essentially to see how one of the new challengers stacks up against the champ.
What are the price differences?
So based on the list price, there's about a $7,000 difference between these cars. The 3 Series starts at $70,900 before on-roads, but our tester had a couple of options packages, and that took it to $79,090. The Genesis starts at $63,000 before on-road costs, but it had one option. The kicker is that option was the $10,000 luxury pack.
What?
So it obviously is a pretty big box of tick, and it takes the price to $73,000 before on-roads. There are some perks to the Genesis regardless. You know, even though it is cheaper, it does come with more equipment. So you get things like heated seats, adaptive cruise control, all sorts of options that you'd really think would be standard on the BMW aren't, but you do get them on the Genesis. But thankfully on the BMW, along with options packs, you can just pick the eyes out of it and go for heated seats and adaptive cruise and adaptive dampers, which we'll get to, as an individual option. So the Genesis is cheaper and better spec'd.
What is the more newer model?
So the Genesis is a newer model in the sense that it's been facelifted recently. Earlier this year, we drove it for the first time, and it's got a new look that's in keeping with all of the other Genesis cars that we've seen recently, like the GV80 and the G80 with the split headlights, the split tail lights, and that really aggressive grille. It looks fantastic. But under the skin, the 3 Series is actually a pre-update version of a newer car. So the Genesis has been given a refresh more recently, but when you sit in the two cars and when you drive them, the BMW feels the more modern.
So let's get to specs. What's under both of the bonnets?
So both of these cars have 2-litre turbocharged engines. This is one of very few BMW badges where the badge number actually matches up with the engine, because obviously in the past a 320i would have had a 2-litre and this actually has a 2-litre engine. It makes 135 kilowatts of power and 300 newton metres of torque. It's got an 8-speed auto and it's rear-wheel drive. So the 100k an hour sprint is about a second slower than the Genesis, and that's because the Genesis has got more grunt. It's got 179 kilowatts and 353 newton metres. It's also got an 8-speed auto. So points to the Genesis on the power front. It's got the BMW pretty comfortably covered. But in the real world, it's not necessarily the nicer car to drive because of it.
I was about to say, it's also worth pointing out that the 3 Series weighs virtually nothing. Like it is an incredibly light car, which kind of makes it feel a bit more agile, even if it doesn't have that sort of same punch.
So speaking of maybe agile, how do they drive? Does the BMW actually feel lighter on the road?
So on the road, the Genesis is definitely the faster of the two cars. A little bit of lag down low and you put your foot down, it just goes. It pulls really hard. It feels a bit like a hot hatch in the way it delivers its performance. And the big difference between the two is the way they ride. The Genesis, though, it rides better than the BMW. So the BMW is on standard dampers, and we're kind of used to BMWs with the M Sport package being a little bit firm. But where the Genesis still handles nicely, still feels like the body's under control, still feels like it, you know, can do everyday driving without stressing you out. The BMW feels quite firm on little lumps and bumps. So, you know, soaks up speed bumps fine, but you hit those little lumpy bits on freeways and little potholes in the city, and it just never quite settles down. It's always moving up and down and feels a little bit tight. And Paul, I know you said the same thing. You did a video with this car. The adaptive dampers are an option. I think they're less than $1,000 when you option them on their own. They're an option that every single person should be ticking on this car, because having driven the car with them, it makes a huge difference. Where the BMW wins back points, though, is with the engine. Even though it's less powerful than the Genesis, it sounds better, which sounds like a silly thing, but the Genesis sounds like a space vacuum cleaner with the sound generator switched on. It makes a really strange induction noise, whereas the BM is super smooth, super quiet, and when you put your foot down, it just goes. There's no lag. It just feels really smooth and really peppy. It also uses a heap less fuel. So BMW claims something pretty ridiculous for what is quite a big car, 6.3 litres per 100 Ks. Genesis claims 9. And on the same road loop, the BMW used significantly less fuel than the Genesis. And in the real world, that obviously makes a difference.
Which car does the interior better?
Even though it has less stuff, the BMW is a much nicer place to be. Genesis has made some changes with this updated G70 because the pre-update car, although it was nice, it always felt a little bit too Hyundai. With this new one, they've given it the new 10.25-inch infotainment screen that pops up in Kia and Hyundai stuff with some unique fonts. It's got a 3D instrument cluster that'll send you cross-eyed unless you turn it down. I first got in there and it was on its most aggressive and my eyes almost popped out of my head. But once it's turned down, it looks quite good. And it's got beautiful Nappa leather, heated and ventilated seats, but it just feels older than the BMW. I'm not being hyperbolic when I say this. There is no leg room behind me. And I realize I'm tall and a bit strange, but with the seat in my seating position, and Mike, I know you commented on this, you could not get anyone in the back seat. You have to have no legs or be a bag to get in there because there's just no space. Whereas the BMW is a little bit bigger, it's got a little bit more headroom up front and it's got a little bit more legroom down back, but it just feels more modern and it feels more solidly put together. So BMW's infotainment is, in my opinion, the best of all the big German brands. You've got the voice control, you've got a touchscreen, you've got a rotary controller on the transmission tunnel. And even though this is the base model, you still get the full digital instrument cluster, you still get a really nice M Sport steering wheel, and it just feels like a proper BMW in there and a bit more solid than the Genesis, which is nice, but just feels a bit old.
Scully, Genesis has obviously got its work cut out for it, you know, trying to succeed in the luxury car market against some of the most famous badges of all. These sort of small sedans have always been the bread and butter of these manufacturers. If we could just come back to the fundamentals of this, we can talk about ride and handling and engine and all those things, but why would somebody buy the Genesis over the BMW? What is its selling point? What is it doing that the Bimmer isn't? And what compelling aspects does it bring to market, if any at all, over the tried and true?
I think the reason you would buy the Genesis is because of the way it looks. And that sounds a little bit reductive maybe because it drives well as well, but I would argue it doesn't drive well enough to justify buying it over the BMW. The reason you'd buy the Genesis is because it looks really, really arresting. It's like a little miniature Bentley in person. I think there are also people out there who don't want a German badge. You know, they want an Alfa Romeo or they want a Volvo or they want a Jaguar. And Genesis, I think, doesn't have the history or the cred of those brands just yet, but there are going to be people out there who like the idea of owning a car that no one knows about. I think where this G70 falls down and the appeal it lacks is maybe in the fact that it's not a full-blown Genesis in the same way the GV80 and the G80, the new ones, are. We've driven the latest Genesis products and they have this really distinctive, luxurious Korean feel. They look really unique. Their interiors are really lavish. They've got their own infotainment controls. And the G70 doesn't quite feel like that. It feels kind of halfway between the old model, which was a nice handling sports sedan that looked like it was a home brand car. It didn't really have an identity to it. And Genesis has tried to inject some of that identity into it, and it still looks good and the interior is interesting, but it hasn't gone as far as it's been able to with its dedicated new products. And I think that's what stands out. So you would buy it to be a bit different and to look a bit different and to stand out. But compared to some of the other stuff in the Genesis range and even the new GV70 SUV or the G70 shooting brake we know is coming, it just doesn't feel all the way there.
Good answer. Lastly, I suppose we should touch on the differences in warranty and servicing.
So BMW, for some reason, I say for some reason, probably because head office won't let them do a 5-year warranty, but it sticks with a 3-year unlimited kilometer warranty. And given the whole mainstream market's gone to 5, 7, or even 10 years in some cases, and its luxury rivals are now going to 5 years, it's really disappointing that BMW hasn't done the same thing. For a 3-year service package, you'll pay just under $1,500. And for a 5-year package, you'll pay $1,750. So you can, if you pay up front for your service packages, get a better deal. But the Genesis blows it away on that front. You've got a 5-year unlimited kilometer warranty for starters, and you also get free servicing and concierge for your servicing. So for the 5 years after you buy the car, every 12 months or 10,000 Ks, someone from Genesis will come and pick your car up and deliver you a car and then return it once it's been serviced, which is a really, really nice feature and borrows a little bit from what Lexus does with its Lexus Encore, I think it's called, services.
Very cool. So I am assuming what you said earlier, the the BMW wins this Camaro?
So the Genesis is better value. It's more interesting than the BMW, and it definitely rides better than the BMW, but I still don't think it's a better car. And coming back to what Moko said earlier, the way these cars handle and all those sort of things are important, but realistically, these are still family cars. They're still cars that people need to drive every day, and all the stuff you touch and use in the BMW just feels more resolved. It feels like a car that's been evolved over almost 50 years, which we know it has been, whereas the Genesis feels like more of a first attempt or an earlier product that with some refining will be really nice, but just doesn't quite have that impressive, well-rounded feel the BMW does.
Mm. All right. Keep your eye on carexpert.com.au for that comparison to go live very soon. Thank you, Scott Colley.
Thanks.
Okay, that's it into this week's podcast. Seeing as it feels like half a country is in lockdown, we don't really have many events or launches happening this week, so we might just stick to the cars that we've got coming up, Paul. What have we got?
Yeah, so Albor's mentioned that we have M4 competition and C63 being driven around the track by ATCO next week. I can't wait to see how that goes. But the funny thing is, all the cars we started off in last week or the week before, we're still stuck in because we aren't sort of returning them. So I have this beautiful Range Rover downstairs with massage seats and everything that hasn't moved for at least a week, which is so disappointing. But we will have reviews coming up of these cars. So they include the Alfa Romeo Giulia QV, so an update to that car, the Range Rover Autobiography that I'm driving, which has a with new Ingenium diesel, the SsangYong Rexton Ultimate, the review of that just went live on our YouTube channel, the Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross. And Mike, you're in a car that suits you down to a T, a beautiful 8 Series convertible.
Yeah, I just bought a house in one of Melbourne's Melbourne's developing suburbs, shall we say, and it's quite. I've had a few tradies come around in the past few days because I'm renovating at the moment, and they've come to this kind of shabby, you know, old weatherboard house, and there's a $250,000 BMW convertible parked in the driveway, and there's been some pretty confused looks in my direction.
Well, it's funny, Moko. I think that they already have the quotes all sorted for you before they even step inside. I think they just literally triple everything on the assumption that you've got too much money.
Who's this tosser with the 8 Series convertible? We're taking him to the cleaners.
Yeah. Well, the best bit is, A, you can't drive the car, and B, it's friggin' freezing at the moment. So it's a pointless car to have right now.
It's funny. Like, we do actually have permits to do driving outside of our bubbles, but a part of me doesn't want to have that conversation. You know, you get pulled over. Are you an essential worker, sir? No, I'm just driving this convertible because I have to write about it. You know, it's a pretty awkward conversation to have, isn't it? Strange world we're living in, Mandy.
It most certainly is. All right. Well, I think it's time to say goodbye once again for this week. Paul Marrick and Mike Costello, thank you.
Thank you, Mandy.
Great to be here, Mandy.